doing. Like, those people aren't as smart as you think. They might, like, or they are and they make mistakes. Like, you will make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. Like, cut yourself some slack. The expectations aren't that high. You have higher expectations for yourself, and don't beat yourself up. And that has, like, those having some of, like, those mantras or, like, a talk track to sort of, like, tone down my inner, like, you can't do this. You shouldn't do this. You're not qualified. You're, you know, like, the chatter that happens in your brain. It's like, yeah, yeah. And that person wasn't qualified. And then they did it and they rocked it. And so why can't that happen to you? Like, you can make that happen. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, I can. So I think that that would be my piece of advice, is the world around you is not as perfect as it seems. Nobody knows exactly what to do 100% of the time. The only thing to do is just keep moving and just keep moving forward and don't overthink it.
Hello and welcome to Developer's Journey, the podcast bringing you the making of stories of successful software developers to help you on your upcoming journey. I'm your host, Tim Bourguignon. On this episode, I receive Britt Myers. Britt is the VP of Engineering at System Initiatives. And more broadly, she's a technology leader with over a decade of experience in the cloud and DevOps space, as well as scaling high-performing engineering teams. Oh, and just to make it more fun, she recently completed an executive MBA from the University of Michigan. What an idea. Britt, welcome to Dev Journey.
Thank you for having me, Tim. Happy to be here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And we have to talk about this. What was that for an idea? Completing MBA? Come on.
Yeah, it was probably not the greatest thing to do, as I was expecting my fourth and in between jobs. But, you know, I'm done.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
But before we come to your story, I want to thank the terrific listeners who support the show every month. You are keeping the Dev Journey lights up. If you would like to join this fine crew and help me spend more time on finding phenomenal guests than editing audio tracks, please go to our website, devjourney.info, and click on the Support Me on Patreon button. Even the smallest contributions are giant steps toward a sustainable Dev Journey journey. Thank you. And now, back to today's guest. So, Britt, as you know, the show exists to help the listeners understand what your story looked like and imagine how to shape their own future. So, as is usual on the show, let's go back to your beginnings. Where would you place the start of your dev journey?
Yeah, my start is, I think, probably later than most. You know, I was not really exposed to CS much, well, at all in high school. I wouldn't really classify myself as a nerd growing up. I wasn't really into video games. So for me, it started in college where I landed an internship at a defense company here in the States, which showed me sort of, you know, leading up into that internship, I had some exposure to programming, basic concepts. I understood the math. I was a math major. But what I never had sort of grasped until that internship was connecting, like, the lines of code I was writing to the impact of what's happening with the service or the product or whatever I'm building. And having that feedback and seeing that what I'm doing is not just solving interesting logic problems or, you know, sort of exercising engineering curiosity or creative curiosity. It was like, oh, I'm writing this code so that this problem in the world is solved. And that was like a light bulb that went off that I haven't been able to turn off ever since.
And it's really something that happens quite often. Until we see the reaction to what we do, it's really hard to really understand. But many developers started with an app, and finally having an app on their own phone, say, whoa, it's not just,
I did this. Yeah, exactly. I built this with my hands and my fingertips and the machine on my desk, you know?
And it's not just in the hello world of my on the console on my machine. It's really something I'm using every day. And that's really the mind-blowing moment. I can really understand that. Yes. So that was working with an internship with a defense contractor in the US.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, at the time, college in the US is incredibly expensive. I had entered college as a math major, and having that internship, what I realized was, like, this is what I want to do, at least for my first job. And I wasn't thinking sort of for the rest of my life, but my goal is to land a job as a software engineer. And I basically oriented as much of my exposure and, like, coursework for the remaining of my degree towards that goal without changing majors, because by God, I did not want to pay for any more years of college. College is expensive.
Okay. What was your major before?
I was math. So I entered as a math major. I graduated as a math major. And, you know, part of my reason for becoming a math major was I knew I liked problem solving. I knew I liked critical thinking. I didn't know what domain to apply that to. And so my thought was like, well, if I can prove that I'm smart by surviving this math program, maybe somebody can like tell me something to be smart about, you know, like show me the problems to solve and give me the tools to solve them. And that internship sort of gave me that like, oh, I can apply my skills here and, you know, have this impact.
Well, it worked all right, I guess.
Yeah, it's paid off so far.
Yeah. So how did you, from the moment you realized, okay, this is what I want to do now, how did you approach the problem? Saying, okay, what do I need to learn? Where do I need to apply? What skills can I value as is? Which ones should I learn, et cetera?
Yeah, I focused heavily on building my CV. So, you know, I took any campus job that had anything that I could add to a resume that said something programming, something software. I would find like side projects to work on and, you know, create a portfolio to sort of evidence, because what I knew was that applying for entry level jobs, I knew that I'd be competing against people who have a computer science undergrad or like more direct academic exposure to the domain. And so I needed to find a way to sort of, how can I compete with those people for these jobs? And so I just pursued work experience. And, you know, most of my exposure was in this, you know, like the defense job I had, and then one of the sort of internships I landed at the university, was this mix between math and computer science and software. So it was never a very like consumer facing sort of approach for me, if that makes sense. You know, it was much more leaning into the, like how vast of a background can I build, and how many different things can I expose myself to show that like I can think broadly, I can learn quickly. And so, yes, I might not have the exact experience you're looking for, but look at all this evidence that I can teach myself and that I can be good at the job anyways, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. For a long-term strategy, absolutely perfect. Was it hard at the beginning, following this strategy?
It was hard. And it was, you know, I had to network a lot. Basically, I had to like find my way in places, because, you know, that first hurdle of, you know, if there's a job posting and there's, you know, 3,000 applicants, 5,000 applicants, even 1,000, even 500 applicants, it's like, I have pretty high confidence in myself, but stack me up against 499 other people. There are plenty of people in this world smarter than me. And one of them maybe could have applied for this job in this moment. And so I networked a ton, which was, I don't know, uncomfortable. And it felt a little bit strange, I think. But, you know, like the relationships that I was able to build, I like really reflect on having a positive impact for me in my career. And so I just sort of, I latched on to that. It's like, yes, obviously you need to be able to do the job and you need to be good at your job. But if people can know you and they can want to work with you also, then that was like the icing on top that I needed. And oftentimes like what sort of pushed me over the edge, in some situations where had I not have done that and put in that effort, I might not have gotten the job, or I might not have gotten, you know, the call or the foot in the door or what have you. So that was, you know, it was a really, a lesson that I learned, I think quite early, is it's not like, it's about like building software and building systems and running systems is still as much about people as it ever was, regardless of how far automation has come. And I've just sort of really never abandoned that idea and leaned hard into the people and the people side of things.
We'll be right back.
Did you know that the first 26 episodes of Dev's Journey were recorded in person? Recording online with good quality was so hard that I tried to avoid it altogether. And then I discovered Zencastr. With Zencastr, my Dev Journey guests only need a web browser, and we can start recording studio quality sound in minutes. It records each participant locally and backs up the files in the cloud while we are talking. It provides such a sense of zen for me, knowing that the guests can just concentrate on telling their journey and nothing else. Publishing a show used to require the use of countless tools to record, edit, post-process, level, tag, host, etc. those days are over. The folks at Zencastr have been adding one feature after the other, and their product now has all you need to focus on what matters, creating your own show. So go over to zencastr.com/pricing and use my promo code DevJourney, and you'll get 30% off your first month, any Zencastr paid plan. I want you to have the same easy experience as I do for all my podcasting and content needs. So now is the time for you to share your story. Oh, hell yeah. I've been facing the same problems and it's never the tech.
It's like, what, yeah, you know, like computers are easy. Like people are hard.
Yep. I remember in college, the major I was in had less and less and less applicants year after year. And at some point, the professor leading the major said, "Hey, do you want to talk to the younger students? I'll organize something." And we talked to them for an hour. And I remember they were asking some dumb questions. And at some point I told them, "Well, but the tech doesn't matter. It's just something that you learn." And that was the major I was in. "The tech doesn't matter. It's just something that you learn. And in the end, it's just people stuff." And I saw the face of the professor wide saying, "You're here to advertise the tech. God damn it."
Yeah. No, we want them to come study this tech here right now. Send us the money for it.
Exactly. But that was already something I had direly understood, this people problem. Yeah. What did you mean exactly when you said you networked a lot, especially from the point of view of not yet major or just graduate?
Yeah, I was still an undergrad. You know, I don't – all of the sort of – platitudes of like I engaged the alumni network. So I was a collegiate athlete and I like heavily resourced the women basketball players, alumni, to sort of get to know them and understand their paths and understand sort of their journey within like on campus, building relationships with professors, with faculty to understand like what their concerns are, what opportunities they're seeing. You know, I was able to, you know, everything from, was a TA for this class. And they paid, you know, at the time, this was like an insane amount of money for a college student to grade papers. It was like $20 an hour to grade papers, you know, however long ago, which when minimum wage is $7, it was like, whoa, you know, and I only ever would have done that if like I'd showed an active interest and built this relationship. And so mm-hmm. when the opportunity came up, my name was in top of mind, you know? And so there are sort of like phrases that I've later learned in my career that, that I've latched onto that I didn't have at the time. But, you know, one example is like having your name spoken in rooms you're not in a positive light. Like the more things you can do so that that situation happens more is like, that's a good thing. And it's like effectively what I was doing. I just didn't really know it by that name. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, you know, it's like you meet somebody and you hear about a thing and, you know, you try not to say no to events, you know, try to just say yes. And the other sort of phrase that sticks with me that, you know, I use with my kids a lot is like, there is so much of life that is just luck. Like it is just right place, right time. And what my goal was to just maximize the chance, the probability that I was in the right place at the right time, mm-hmm. you know? And so if the question was like, is there anything in this for me? It's like, well, is there like, will this be harmful? You know, is this going to like detract from what I'm doing? And if the answer wasn't an obvious no, then that means therefore there's a chance that that could be the right place at the right time where I meet mm-hmm. the one person to do the thing. And so much of my career has been this, you know, been a product of that happenstance where I can point at moments in time and I can arguably say I busted my ass to get there. And also it was the right place at the right time. And something I had no control over was the thing that also was needed, you know, for situations to work out the way that they did. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, you have to, that I'm an extrovert. I'm very outgoing, but I do have a ton of social anxiety, like showing up to like networking events. Like it's incredibly, still to this day, like incredibly uncomfortable. I have to like talk myself into it every time. And part of the talk track every time is, you know that this has resulted in good things. Like, just go do it, you know?
It's the second time I think about this book this week, and I didn't research the name. I completely forgot about it. It was basically describing that luck is not just a factor of luck, but being prepared for it and being ready for it.
Right.
And they had some numbers behind it, some studies showing that basically companies they were focusing on companies less on people.
Yeah.
Companies that experienced lucky moments actually didn't have more lucky moments than the others. They were just able to leverage them more than the others. And yep. So what you're describing is getting ready for it, is really done the moves and being there. And when a lucky moment appears, being able to recognize it and grasp it.
Precisely. Yeah. I love that. Yeah, I love that. That's exactly it. Exactly it.
I also love how you started this answer saying, well, go to your TA or professors and understand their concerns. And it's something that I've been hearing often is networking. It's not about you. It's really studying about the others, their concerns, their interests. You're nodding heavily right now.
Yes. This is something my grandfather actually taught this to me like very young. Like he'd always say, whether it's this, you know, as a child, when like kids often have so little control over what's happening in their lives, right? It's like you have to go to school. There's all these rules. The schedule is out of their control. The menus are often out of their control. It's like there's all these details and moments where children, they just have to deal, you know, and then the path is laid for them or the decisions are made. And focusing on what you can control to influence what the path is in the going forward. Like that was just something my grandfather like really drilled home for me, which is, let's say you have a teacher and let's say you hate this teacher. Like you don't like their style. They're not working for you. You think they're maybe a little bit too mean or, you know, passive aggressive, whatever. None of that matters. What matters is that teacher has some control over you that you don't, AKA your grade. And so if you can just figure out what that teacher wants, and this is he's telling me to this as a child, if you can figure out what the teacher wants and give it to them, you'll pass the class. Like 9 times out of 10, you'll pass the class. And so some teachers are, you know, professors in college. Sometimes it's, you know, being willing to show up to office hours or like asking for extra help or being proactive in helping other students. Or sometimes teachers really hate that. Like, don't help the other students. They want them to struggle and learn how to struggle and learn how to learn and get through it. And every teacher, every sort of like authority figure, if you will, has something slightly different about them. And if you can understand what that is and learn what they want and what they appreciate and what they value, figure out a way to give it to them, nothing but good things will happen. Like, that is just a recipe that will just result in good things. And I think it's like very similar to what you're describing, which is when you network, part of what you're doing is you're looking for ways that this person can help you, but you have to acknowledge they don't want to help you for the sake of themselves. Like they're there for a reason too. You know, they have problems, they have concerns. And so as much as you can make that bi-directional and as early as you can figure that out, like the better it's going to be. That applies to teachers, it applies to parents to some degree, although maybe it shouldn't so much. But bosses, teammates, you know, indirect bosses, skip levels, your product managers, your project managers, right? Like all of those roles, they have some amount of control that you don't have. Figure out what they need to do, figure out what's important to them and help them get there. And everything will be better if you just follow that, path.
Is it something that, is it something that is in your guts now and you do it by default, or is it something that you verbalize and that you have to do with new connections and when you face problems?
I think it's pretty default because in the pre-call we were talking and like you talk about influence and influencing others, and there's a spin on that word influence, which is like manipulation, right? And I think what the instinct that I have tuned is like how to influence the situations that I'm in to have the outcomes that I want. And so that part has become more natural because I try to want the right things. I try to want the things that are better for everybody to some degree, you know? And so that part comes natural. And the part that I do, you know, overtly or sort of explicitly talk through is when I'm building that relationship, it has to be bi-directional, you know? And so I have to be open and authentic and transparent with the person, because nobody wants to be sold. Nobody wants to be manipulated. You know, it's like the logical, the negative logical conclusion of what I'm describing is a really awful person doing really awful things selfishly. And that's not at all what I'm, not at all what I'm getting at. And so it, if I start with this instinct and then I approach it authentically with a person to build a relationship, like it just, I don't, I found that people can, they can see through more than you realize. Mm-hmm. And so it just, if you take it too far, it just, it is, as soon as it becomes not authentic, it fails, I suppose. I don't know that I exactly answered your question, but
good enough.
It was a hard question to answer.
Yes, it was. No, you did fantastic. Let's roll back a little bit. We went on this networking tangent, which was fantastic. But how did you enter then the industry? Being a math major with a lot of CV-driven buzzwords on your resume, how was that? How did that go?
Yeah, I went to college and I'm from Cleveland, where I still live now, Cleveland, Ohio. I went to college in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is just a short 2-hour drive. And at the time when I graduated, I had a long-term college boyfriend. And so the question was, like, am I moving home and getting married and having kids, or am I not? And sort of the not, the other was like this open vastness of like, I don't know anything ever in the world, I guess I could be, you know, like, what do I want to be when I grow up? And I'm in Cleveland with 4 kids and my then long-term boyfriend is now my husband. So I basically targeted Cleveland, the Cleveland market for jobs, and leveraged, you know, I talked to everybody that I could, that I knew in sort of the Cleveland network that I had, and to branch out to just like, what are the companies? You know, I Googled it. What are the companies to work for in Cleveland? Who's hiring software engineers, and what are the companies' cultures like? And so I started from sort of like city, then to company, and then I'd picked a few companies and like, okay, these are companies I think I want to work for. And I applied through the websites to all of them. And most of them, I say, I don't know, maybe, I think I whittled the list down to like 5 companies. 3 of the 5 companies, I had an in. So like I knew somebody who like used to work there or does work there or what have you. Interviewed them, you know, called like, say, hey, can you connect me to like, oh, I heard your brother worked for this company. Can I meet him? Can I talk to him? You know? So I had some phone calls with people like, what are they looking for in the interview? And like, what are the things that they value? And how do I know if it's going well? And tried to get, you know, obviously this was, now there's like website, like Glassdoor didn't exist then in this way. You know, you can get this information online now. I couldn't get it online then. And so met as many people as I could. And ironically enough, the people, the companies I'd applied to, the jobs I applied to where I knew somebody, those were the ones I had callbacks from. And those are the ones I had, and the ones that I did not know anybody, I didn't get callbacks for. So I don't know. That's like a sample size of one. I don't, you know, correlation versus causation. But yeah, I ended up taking the job that I ended up spending, you know, almost a decade at that job that I first got in Cleveland. I was there for a very long time. And it was amazing. But I, you know, I can look back from that moment and think like, okay, if I wouldn't have done this, this wouldn't have happened. If I wouldn't have done this wouldn't have happened. You know, like there's a bit of like a butterfly effect that I do, which is like, was it worth it? Like I'm working really hard. Was all of this worth it? I'm like, yes. Yes, it has been worth it.
As the Frenchman living in Germany who met his wife in Chicago working for Siemens in an internship, I can relate a little bit. Oh boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can. Yeah. Okay. So you stayed 10 years with the same company. Mm-hmm. How did your role evolve during this time?
It evolved like crazy. So, and part of why I stayed for 10 years is it was just so much fun. I was working alongside amazing people solving awesome problems. And like the company had changed so much. So it's like while I was there for a decade, it was almost like I had worked for like 5 or 6 different companies over the course of that time because of how vast the projects were or how fast the sort of changes were and evolutions in the company. So, you know, I started on a team of 3 as a junior software developer was my title. And by the time I left, I was the associate vice president of cloud engineering and managing over 200 engineers around the world and all the cloud native sort of development teams. So wow. Like that was the trajectory of like the company, you know, like when I started, they had, maybe a little less than like around 1,000 employees total, but it was a 20 plus year old company, software B2B company. And you know, over the course of my career, by the time I left, the company had 4,000 employees and numerous product lines and tons of acquisitions. And, it was just a, you know, every few years it was a whole, like I said, it was like a whole new company, and it was fun. It was engaging. I learned so, so much. I had amazing mentors. I did not expect to stay there that long when I applied. You know, I did not expect to stay there that long, even just like after my first year. It was like, you know, this is fun. This will be cool. These people are nice. I'll stay a few years and then find the next thing, you know, as most people my age did. Then I didn't end up doing that.
Well, I'm not shabby anyway. So, do you remember when you transitioned from an individual contributor role to a management role?
Yeah. I'm trying to think years. I'm so bad at years. So I mentioned I started on a small team, and that team that I started on, I became the team lead of. And that was sort of, you know, at the time it wasn't a tech lead, it was a team lead. And so it was, you know, all of the sort of career growth responsibilities with none of the hiring and firing and money salary side, right?
Okay.
And so that really gave me a taste of, you know, the impact, like the transition you have to make when going from an individual contributor to some form of like explicit leadership. Like one of the things I had to learn was like how to let go and how to find the same sort of like satisfaction, not from using my hands on the keyboard all day, you know, 10 hours a day, 5 days a week or whatever, you know? And that was hard at first because you have this identity crisis of like, well, wait a second. Like I've learned the skill, I've honed the skill, and you hired me to do the skill. And now I'm not doing this quite so much anymore. What am I even doing here? Like, you know, like I'd have more days than not where it's like, what did I even do today? You know, like what is it that you say that you do here? It's like, well, I talked to a lot of people. I helped some people through some stuff. We had some planning conversations, you know, and like it took a while for that to feel like work. And even, you know, this is a conversation we have with the team a ton, which is even still, it's hard. It's hard to like innately feel that as work, but it is so much of the work because it's all of those interactions, all of that, like everything about that can have either a negative, positive, or neutral effect on the outcomes that you're trying to give. Right. And so it's like, when you think of it in that perspective, like, yeah, it's work. And sometimes it doesn't feel like it, but it is. And that was probably one of the more harsh, I don't know, lessons that I learned, so to speak.
Is this the direction you wanted to go, or were you pushed, or did you stumble in there?
I didn't explicitly want it in terms of like, I did not. So like the internship that I had in college and like the sort of exposure, like the work experience I had, none of that was in like a large organization with a team and a management structure and a hierarchy of managers, right? Like none of that existed, or at least it didn't exist in a way that like I acknowledged that it was a reality, you know, like it was sort of opaque to me. And so from that perspective, there wasn't this like, oh, I worked for this great engineering manager, and so what I want to be when I grow up is like just like that person. Like I didn't have that. But I always have sort of like naturally gravitated towards leadership roles. You know, if you think like Girl Scouts as a kid, or, you know, like basketball teams, like who wants to be the team captain? Like I wanted to be the team captain, and I wanted to have a positive influence on other people. So like from that perspective, like I had, like my instinct said leadership, but what was this black box is like, but I don't actually know what leadership is. Like, I don't know the ins, I don't know the outs, I don't know the politics, I don't even know what factors say whether or not you'd be good or bad. Like, I had no semblance of that. And so because of that, I didn't have it sort of the title on my resume in the future with the year is like, this is my goal. Not at that point. And it was, you know, part of it was there was a vacuum, you know, somebody got promoted. And so my boss got promoted and there was an opening, and it's like, oh, do I want it? It's like, well, would it be bad for me? You know, I kind of go back to the, like, will it be bad for my career if I take this? And I thought, no, I mean, this would not be a bad move for my career. I'm either going to love it or I'm going to hate it. And if I hate it, I just won't do it anymore. And now I'll know that's not the path for me, you know? And so I just sort of like use the same thing that I've used my whole life, which is, there's a need and I think I could be good at it and I'm going to build the relationships and try to do the best I can to make my boss happy and make him look good, you know? And I took it and, you know, I was given the job.
And it's been 10 years.
So, and it's been 10 years.
You must be doing something right. So when you moved to from one job to the other, so I have your LinkedIn open and you have had quite a few leadership positions or executive positions in the past years. What do you look for in a next position? What is kind of your algorithm to vet a position and decide if you want to get there, especially with the point of view of having led a 200 engineer team at the very beginning or at the end of this 10-year tenure? What could you be looking for in the next job?
It's a lot like individual contributors in the like culture side. So culture is important. Like for me, it's incredibly important. You know, like there are ways that I believe this work should be done. And if I work for somebody or with other people who have like two drastically different of this like ideal state of like how the job gets done, I know I won't thrive. I know I won't be successful. And I'm, you know, setting myself up for these like ideological challenges. So, you know, the cultural fit for me is like a combination of like ideologies in management, ideologies in, I don't know, like the socio-technical impact, ideologies, like similarities in approach, like those things I look for now. And those were things that I had to sort of like through my management growth chart, like these were things I had to learn about myself, about like what works, what doesn't work, like how will it work best and how won't it? And so like all of those rose to the top for me. And so especially like where I am, you know, I'm in my early 30s. I just got an MBA. Like I want to grow, I want to learn, and I want to have an impact. And so, you know, I look for like in where I landed at System Initiative, it's like I was looking for a team of leaders that I could both contribute to and learn from, you know, that there were things that I had that it would be like a net value add to the team and that there were things I could take away and grow personally. And that was a big thing for me. And the second piece is I need to feel passionate about what we're building. So like whatever the business model is, whoever the purchaser is on the end of the table, like it has to, like I want it to have a positive impact. You know, I'm not, there have been plenty of jobs that I've turned down that were more money, that were in a vertical or in an area that it's like, I just, you know, like I'm not going to put my heart into this because I just don't care. You know, this isn't a problem I think is worth solving, or, you know, like, it's not going to keep me waking up excited to come to work in the morning. Mm-hmm. Like I need to feel good about the work. And this is like a, you know, I'm not a, I don't know how to describe it. I'm not a purist in, I have these values. And so I'm only going to go look for, you know, I'm only going to look for companies that build tools in this space or are like solving this problem. It's more like, can I understand the approach they're taking? Can I understand the customers we're trying to sell to? And do I want to help with that mission? You know, like, do I want to do it? and that's the other piece that, you know, for like, if you look at my LinkedIn, like I've never worked for a consumer's product. I've never worked B2B. And so part of that is for this reason of like, I love the idea of building something that lets customers, you know, lets other companies do better things, you know? And so it's like this amplifying effect, and I love the amplifying effect. And so even as I look, I'm pretty focused, you know, B2B. I did not consider effectively any other sort of like software companies for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but looking it through lens of the amplifying effect, being in cloud and DevOps is kind of really amplifying.
it is. And it's funny, like that even is, that's a, it's an accident that this is the space that I have fallen most in love with.
Really?
And by that, I mean, you know, throughout my time at that first job, I just ran face first into DevOps out of pure, like, we have a problem to solve. And like, how can I solve this problem? You know? And the problem at first was we're planning in too big of chunks and we're project managing and all of these features that the team is building, none of them are being used. That doesn't feel like it doesn't feel like nobody feels good when that happens. And so it's like, okay, so something, we're wrong about something. Like, how can we be more right? How can we build things that people actually want, you know? And so what I thought was a sort of scoping problem. I'm like, maybe it's an agile problem. You know, maybe we're just planning too big and maybe we're not taking, you know, or having the right conversations. We're not talking about problems that we're trying to solve in the right way. And so I approached it from a very like process, like our process isn't working because the output to the process is features that aren't being used. And so I experimented a lot to try to solve that problem of process. And I got to a place where I'm like, man, I'm really proud of this process. Like everything, looking at this process, like it should work. Why isn't it working? And it's like, oh, well, it's not working because it takes us 6 weeks to deploy to production. So even if the scope of the work is a 2 week chunk of experimental A/B, you know, like if I'm going to feature flag a feature and ship it to production and see if they want it before we commit, what was happening was we'd spend 2 weeks building something, 6 weeks trying to deploy it, 2 or 3 weeks fixing things as it went wrong. And now it was like, oh, so how did that 2 week experiment go? That, you know, like how's the new little button? And it was just so far apart. So that, you know, and you can sort of see how the story ends with like, and then DevOps, mm-hmm. because why does it take that long? And why does it go wrong so often? And so it was purely from this, like, I just want to have a better outcome. I want my engineers to feel fulfilled. I want them to be happy. I want them to be proud of the work that they're doing, because the more proud they could be, the better work that they do, the more that they grow, you know, it's like, it's good for everybody. And I ended up just right in DevOps. And now it's been impossible to not see problems as DevOps problems sort of ever since, which is, you know, the feedback loops are too long. You can't collab, you know, it's like there's all of these things and engineering leadership is well positioned and it is our job as managers to solve these problems because these are, you know, like that's the job description. It's like mm-hmm. removing the roadblocks and what have you. So yeah, it was an accident and I'm like just so happy because I love the space. I love the people. And these problems, it doesn't matter what size of company you are. It doesn't matter, you know, what country you live in or what your product is. Like these are like ubiquitous problems. And so back to that amplifying effect, it's like, ooh, if we can solve these problems, think about the impact we can have, you know? Mm-hmm. It is. It's exciting.
It is indeed. coming back to the exact example you gave, do you think that what is often sold as the promise of DevOps, hitting for those maybe DORA metrics or whichever you call them, really shortening cycles, focusing on less a measurable amount of issues, etc., would solve the process problems you had before?
I don't think so. I think that they can help tell you what they can. I think all of what you just described can give you signals to like what the problems are to solve. So I don't think that the answer is in like, if I could release on a dime, does that mean that I'm printing money? No. But if I can't release it on a dime, the likelihood that you can prevent money like is probably way lower, right? And so I mm-hmm. see all of those as like enabling factors to get to the root problem for our industry, which is just the product development. Like that it's not the problem, that is the business. The business is like who can create the best product and then execute on delivering it and maintaining it over time. And like that thought process and that sort of that space is company building, it's product building, it's, you know, that's not a software problem. That's just business, you know? Is the business valid? Is it business viable? Am I building something that people want? Are they willing to spend money on it? Like those are the questions that are the hardest to answer, but all of these things end up being in the way of getting that answer and giving us false signals or giving us, you know, false hope potentially. If it goes, you know, you can have, you know, signals that say, hey, we're really great in this area. until, you know, it's like 90% of the time it works 80% of the time, but 5% of the time it blows up 100%. You know, like you end up with all these situations where the answer to everything is it depends. And I think we really need to like think about how we approach the space in terms of like, is it just tweaking these knobs to be faster on these like in between steps, or is it actually like we're looking at the system fundamentally wrong? And if you looked at the system differently, like what could be possible if? And that line of thinking is much more fun than the other, much more risky, but it is much more fun to sort of approach things from that way. And, you know, as you know, startups kind of give you the exact sort of expectation that like that is what you're expected to do, is, you know, think in those ways, which is just which is so fun.
Amen to that. Is it the kind of thinking that led you to exploring an MBA or following an MBA?
Sort of. So going back to what we talked about in terms of like being in the right place at the right time and are you ready, the MBA for me was more in that like, will I be ready? And what I know is that I like leading. What I know is that I like executing. You know, I'm not necessarily the idea person myself. Like I wouldn't say I'm not the serial entrepreneur. Like, yes, I have interesting ideas, but like most of them I think are garbage. But what I love to do is work with somebody who has amazing ideas that like everybody thinks are amazing ideas, and then like help them do it and then help figure out like what the way is, right? So it's like if I run with that as sort of one of my strengths and something that I really enjoy doing is, you know, partnering up with creative folks and helping to solve the problems that they see in the ways that they see it. Will I at some point be in a situation where the information that I will have learned through a grad school program gives me like more context and more confidence in like the decision-making process, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was on that lens. And then the other side was just, none of this matters in today's society, none of it matters unless it makes money, which is like an unfortunate part of the game, but it's the game we all play and I want to win the game. So there's an element of like, if I can learn the game and speak the language of the game, which is speak the language of business, that I am like, again, best positioned to win the game that we all have to play, even if we don't want to, you know?
Mm-hmm. I fully understand. Don't have an MBA, but a couple of years of startup under my belt, which is kind of exactly the opposite, but the same thing.
Yeah. Well, and that was the other calculus for me too. It's like, all of what I learned, there are lots of ways to learn that information. And part of the degree for me and part of like the school that I went to was, okay, yeah, I need to learn this information. But what if like in the process of learning it, I build these amazing relationships and meet some people who like I want to be in my inner circle and I want to be in my network. And that was like a huge part of it too. Mm-hmm. Which like is like just, I don't know, you know, it was like a plus one,
We're back to networking there.
Back to networking. Yeah. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Sticking to networking and maybe to mentoring or helping younger developers, is there some kind of advice that you give again and again?
Yeah. I, you know, as many people in the industry do, I'm somebody who suffered from extreme imposter syndrome. And the thing that has helped me is just reminding myself that like nobody actually really knows what they're doing. Like those people aren't as smart as you think. They might like, or they are and they make mistakes. Like you will make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. Like cut yourself some slack. The expectations aren't that high. You have higher expectations for yourself and don't beat yourself up. And that has like those, having some of like those mantras or like a talk track to sort of like tone down my inner, like, you can't do this. You shouldn't do this. You're not qualified. You're, you know, like the chatter that happens in your brain. It's like, yeah, yeah. And that person wasn't qualified and then they did it and they rocked it. And so why can't that happen to you? Like you can make that happen. It's like, oh yeah, okay, I can. So I think that would be my piece of advice is the world around you is not as perfect as it seems. Nobody knows exactly what to do 100% of the time. the only thing to do is just keep moving and just keep moving forward and don't overthink it. That would be my advice.
And thank you for that. Not just for the show, but also on a personal note, I'm right in the middle of a 360. And so that's also good to hear, I can tell you. Britt, it's been fantastic. Thank you so much for this roller coaster.
Thank you for having me. This is great. This is awesome.
That was cool. Where would be the best place to continue the discussion with you?
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. I'll send you the link. I do have a Twitter or whatever, X handle, but it's not very active. And I would say, you know, if you're interested in sort of exploring more of the like socio-technical conversation or like more specific conversations, System Initiative has a Discord with a bunch of sort of DevOps focused folks and people passionate about the space. Would love to have you come pop in there and have some interesting conversations as well.
And we'll add all those links in the show notes. So just scroll down and click on it and you'll be right there. Anything else you want to plug in?
No. Thank you so much. This is so fun.
Fantastic. Thanks to you. And this has been another episode of Diverse Journey. I will see each other next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot for tuning in. I hope you have enjoyed this week's episode. If you like the show, please share, rate, and review. It helps more listeners discover those stories. You can find the links to all the platforms the show appears on our website, devjourney.info/subscribe. Talk to you soon.